This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 20 years ago, type 2 diabetes in children was not common, but today it is. It's so common that it can actually mask in society that this is a preventable chronic disease that frequently results in tragedy. Yes, there is plenty to be done to manage and prevent type 2 diabetes in children, but is that happening? Well, take a look around you. Yeah, not so much. So today, in our week-long series on diabetes, we're looking at childhood type 2 diabetes. We certainly want to hear from you. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also tweet at us at TPRSource, email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can text us at that number, 833-877-8255. Are you worried, concerned that childhood diabetes could be found in your household? Were you diagnosed as a child type 2 diabetes? How has that journey been for you? What would you tell your younger self now if you had that opportunity? And how could we benefit from your experience? Call in 833-TPR-TALK. We're joined this afternoon by Dr. Jane Lynch, professor of pediatric endocrinology in the Long School of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio, and a physician with University Health Texas Diabetes Institute. And Dr. Lynch, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, and we're great to have you here. We're happy to have you. Rose Ann Barajas is with us, a clinical researcher, coordinator in the pediatric type 2 diabetes unit at the UT Health San Antonio. Rose Ann Barajas, it's great to have you today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be part of this important discussion.
And we're joined by Fida Basha, a doctor, Fida Basha, associate professor of pediatric endocrinology and diabetes at Baylor College of Medicine and the Texas Children's Hospital. Dr. Basha, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be part of this discussion.
So, Dr. Basha, this statistic that jumps out at us, that this used to be something not so common, early childhood diabetes, type 2 diabetes, didn't really happen 20, 30 years ago. Now it's almost, we see it all the time. What happened?
So this happened very suddenly over the past few decades. And if you look at the data, the rates of obesity were rising for some decades before that happened. So there's this parallel increase in the rates of youth onset type 2 diabetes coinciding with increased rates of obesity in children. There is definitely a genetic predisposition, but the gene pool has not changed so much over these past couple of decades. So the importance of environment and childhood obesity is likely the major driver of what we're seeing with the rates of type 2 diabetes in youth.
And Dr. Lynch, we're hearing that with the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic, and people being at home so much and the change in lifestyle, this is aggravated? This has increased the rate of childhood diabetes?
Well, it certainly didn't help. And Roseanne can attest to even the impact on some of our research kids with type 2 diabetes, having them not at school with less supervision and probably some less healthy meals definitely led to significant weight gain. A lot of our kids who were teetering on the verge of type 2 did progress into type 2 and often presented very sick at the hospital. We do have some preliminary information coming out for why we're seeing as well in the diabetic individuals in the adult wards that the COVID-associated complications have been extraordinarily severe and led to more mortality and ICU admissions. And there's some good science now linking not only changes in lifestyle during COVID and stress during COVID, but also some specific damage to the pancreatic beta cell for insulin production related to COVID infections.
Right. We'll dig into that a little bit more. Roseanne Barajas, can you tell me more about what you've seen with children during the pandemic and how they're doing with diabetes?
So the stay-at-home orders, as necessary as they were, certainly exacerbated the risk factors as they relate to diabetes. And you mentioned this in your introductory comments, that children have had, over the last year and a half, limited activity, physical activity. They've also experienced an increase in screen time. Their sedentary behaviors have become more normal in regards to them being encouraged to get out there and be more active. We've also seen that a lot of these children have very disruptive sleep patterns, which we are finding has a correlation to diabetes. And then obviously, as everybody has already shared, the increase in the intake of processed foods has certainly been a hindrance in having these kids stay healthier longer. What we are seeing, particularly with the children that were part of the stay-at-home orders, what we saw was we as clinicians really relied on school nurses to implement certain protocols to ensure compliance in medication taking, in checking blood sugars, in doing that Texas risk assessment for type 2 diabetes. And all of those were interrupted. And as a result, the compliance in medication taking, the compliance in healthier, more nutritional meals went to the wayside over the last year.
So the disruption that we've all dealt with and increase in eating snacks at home, the junk food, that's not a good combination. And so Dr. Fida Basha, what have you seen?
Our experience here in Houston is similar to what has been shared by the panel so far. And unfortunately, also we're seeing kids with new onset type 2 diabetes coming in sicker and needing to be hospitalized. This is what has happened during the pandemic in terms of changes in the lifestyle, definitely is very worrisome to us in terms of what's going to come next with increased rates of type 2 diabetes and complications related to a poorer management, lack of interaction with the physicians and the diabetes care team. Hopefully we go back to normal as soon as possible, and we continue emphasizing the importance of lifestyle and engagement with the care providers to prevent complications.
Yeah, but the problem is that this is not a deficit that can be made up. If we have people who have become diabetic during this pandemic, and suddenly we go back to normal, whatever that might be, is not going to be able to snap back and go to for these individuals. So we've got to figure out how to find a way to have healthy lifestyles in the world we inhabit now. So and what to do about people who have how to help them manage the diabetes, especially the children. If you got a question or a comment, if you have gone through this in your household, if you could talk to your younger self now that you have become been diagnosed with diabetes, what would you say? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is Diabetes Week. This is such an important issue here in San Antonio that we're dedicating the entire week to talking about it. And today we're focusing on children, young adults, and diabetes. If you've got a question or comment, call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Dr. Jane Lynch, Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. I'm going to throw a curveball at you, okay? Hope you don't mind this crazy question. And the other guest, if you have something to say, I'd like to hear it. So I've seen this on the internet. I don't know if it's true, you know, because it's the internet. But people who say that because of high fructose corn syrup, how it entered into our diet right around the time that we've seen this explosion of diabetes in our society. There must be research into that. And do you know anything? Is there a connection?
A lot of research, and there's a fair amount of controversy, but it's clear that when advertising, well, it's clear that the fructose corn syrup really increased the density of sugar in foods, and that there's a real almost a scandal of the way foods are advertised, and especially reach out to advertise to children for being salty and sweet and taking up shelf space. That really was minimally regulated in the early years of the uptick in childhood obesity. So it definitely is one of many factors that contributed to what we saw over the past 20 years.
And Roseanne Barajas, so what we feed our children, I mean, we can, as adults, we have a lot of power over what kind of food the children are going to be able to get, especially when they're younger. And was it because, you know, us adults, we made bad choices?
So I think what we're seeing is the cleverness of marketing. When you see all of the marketing that is done on the time periods that children are watching TV or that are having screen time, as parents, we would hope we have a better judgment on what to be purchasing for our children. But what we are seeing is that the story that the children are that they're playing in their mind, that these are healthy foods, these are better options, aren't really looking at the nutritional value of what they're asking their parents to buy. And we all know that our children can also wear us down at times, and particularly if these foods are have a shelf life that is longer than fresh produce, than some of the healthier options that are in the grocery store, that tends to also be one of those dilemmas that we face as parents.
Let's go to the phone lines, 833-877-8255. And we have Joe on the air. Hey, Joe, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Big fan of the show. Listen to you all the time. I just wanted to speak about the portrayal of the manageability of diabetes. And just in, I am diabetic, and in my personal experience, it's really not as manageable as one might hear in the media or even from friends and family. And I'm sure that manageability differs from individual to individual, but I can say that it's, in my opinion, really not as quote-unquote manageable as you might hear. Anyhow, thank you very much for the time, and have a great day.
All right, Joe, thank you for the call. So, Dr. Fida Basha, if you could talk about, you know, the expectation that we put out there that this is a manageable disease. And in a way that is kind of, there's a little judgy stuff going on there with that discussion. So how manageable is it?
Well, I thank Joe for his comment, and he brings up a very important issue. And definitely, we as physicians and healthcare providers want to take judgment out of the equation and help our patients manage this very demanding disease. A chronic illness, often multiple family members are affected, and it is very demanding. So we would like to change the conversation about how to do this as a team and tackle different aspects of the contributing factors to poor disease management, you know, including nutrition, including physical activity, but also medications. And hopefully with the advancement in therapeutics, there are more options to help manage the disease once it has occurred, and try to prevent complications by the early detection, adding medications that would help in addition to having multi-specialty, multi-disciplinary approach to help the person with diabetes take care of this illness and for the team to be always there to help them troubleshoot anything that may come up, particularly in children.
But Roseanne Barajas, we hear it all the time that this is a lifestyle-related disease. And all you have to do is change your lifestyle or get your kids out of the house and make them exercise, and then you will be on taking steps to manage your diabetes. But that is not that easy to do.
You are correct about that. You know, we oftentimes find that we have families of newly diagnosed pediatric patients with type 2 diabetes come in and say that, you know, grandfather is on dialysis and, you know, doing dialysis three times a week. And mom, the mother of the child, is on multiple oral medications or injectable medications. And the child who's just put on one medication, metformin usually being the first medication we go to, they tend to prioritize the illness based on the progression as they see it, with the grandfather being the most sickly. However, we do know that with pediatric population, they are so much more vulnerable that it is easy for their diagnosis to escalate and exasperate the family to a point where it is where it becomes unmanageable and they shut down. So it is a challenge.
Right. And but Roseanne, I wonder about, you know, maintaining motivation and having the focus and the, you know, the discipline in order to have change your lifestyle, avoid unhealthy foods that we all know are super delicious. And, you know, and if you're diabetic, you know, with your blood sugars ups and downs, that impacts your state of mind too. I mean, is that all something to be considered?
It absolutely is. And as Dr. Lynch and Dr. Bhatta mentioned, there is this correlation of high blood sugars and how it impacts the mental disposition of our patients. Motivation, staying in.
Okay, I think we lost the call. So Dr. Lynch, could you pick up that thread?
Sure, I will gladly. So we know there's a higher risk for depression when your blood sugars are high, and that treating depression is more difficult to do and often requires medication. We also know, and we're hoping to at least broach this a bit during this call, that our new 15-year outcomes from the TODAY study, a long-term longitudinal study of kids with type 2 diabetes, shows markedly more rapid progression of complications in youth. It went up through the mid-20s, and pretty high rates of depression. It is an unforgiving disease, and it requires, in children at least, more than just lifestyle changes. It really requires medication, supervision, and within 3 years, more than half will require insulin or some secondary medication compared to adults who might go 10 years without requiring further treatment. So everything about puberty and teenage years that makes those years already hard are really exaggerated in a child with type 2 diabetes who has a lot of other struggles as well.
This is a tough question, Dr. Lynch. If a child, you know, before they're, what, like maybe they're 10 or 12, they get diagnosed with childhood diabetes, what does that mean for their expected lifespan?
Okay. Well, it's pretty dismal. So we just published, like I said, we just published our long-term outcomes in New England Journal last month. And I can tell you that, to our shock, really, we found that the at a mean age of 26, that more than two-thirds had hypertension, more than half had high lipids, more than half had kidney disease. And we were seeing changes such as retinal, severe retinal visual changes in some of these patients in their 20s. We saw 17 very serious cardiovascular events, including heart attacks and heart failure, and we saw 6 deaths. And this is at an average age of 26 with 13 years of diabetes. Probably worsened dramatically by the pubertal hormones that coincided with the hyperglycemia during their pubertal years.
Right. So when you go into puberty, your body releases growth hormone, which increases insulin insensitivity, right?
Exactly. And some of the peaks of pubertal hormones. And so we know that there's something about that perfect storm that rapidly progresses the risk for complications in youth that is uniquely different than adults who are diagnosed in their 20s and 30s.
So you're saying this study with these adults in their mid-20s, high blood pressure, high fat levels in their blood, kidney disease, nerve damage, eye disease happening to them. So you get diagnosed with childhood diabetes. What's your lifespan going to be?
This was a 15-year study. It's pretty ominous findings and has had a fair amount of press for being really much more serious than people imagined for what the outcomes will be. And Fida, Dr. Bacha might want to comment on this. One of the other not yet published parts of that study are the risks for pregnancy. And young women with type 2 diabetes, of which two-thirds of kids diagnosed with type 2 are female across the country, have a threefold risk for preterm, tenfold risk for congenital anomalies, and ninefold risk of stillbirths with their pregnancies. This was really data that was never appreciated until we tracked it carefully. And these are kids who were cherry-picked to be in a study, willing to follow the rules, had us getting them into high-risk OB and monitoring them. So we can't even imagine what the rates are of these complications and of pregnancy complications in kids who were not enrolled in a study that paid for their meds, paid for their transportation, paid incentives for them to do well from the beginning of their diagnosis.
So Dr. Fida Bacha, this is a tragic disease.
It is. It is absolutely tragic disease when it happens in childhood. It is exposing someone to all these risk factors for a prolonged period of time. So you can imagine how that may lead to much higher morbidity and mortality than we see in adults. Although we don't have right now the projections for mortality for youth onset diabetes, we know that in adults, the years of life lost to diabetes is about 5 years, and it is higher for those diagnosed earlier in the 18 to 44 year of age, about 8 years of life lost due to diabetes. It is tragic in children that we are seeing these high rates of complications, and so that by mid-adulthood, these young individuals are having to deal with things like heart failures and kidney disease. So we want to do everything possible so that we can prevent these complications.
Right. So the best way to deal with childhood diabetes is to prevent childhood diabetes. So we have to identify the risk factors and what can be done in order to help these children so that they can have a long, healthy life without all of the loss of quality of life as well. So we're going to continue this conversation after this break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source. We'll be right back. Back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week we're focusing on diabetes. It is a huge problem here in San Antonio. We have to talk about it. We have to raise awareness. We have to share our stories. We certainly want to hear from you to talk about your journey with diabetes. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Tomorrow we're going to be focusing on COVID-19 in diabetes. If you are diabetic and you caught COVID-19, then you are going to be dealing with some complications. What do you need to know about that? But right now, let's go to the phones. And the number again is 833-TPR-TALK. And we have Hildy. Hildy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Mr. Davies, I really appreciate the topic this week. And I have to say that as a San Antonian and diagnosed when I was six, I've been a diabetic for more than 4 decades. I want to commend your caller who talked to the idea of the manageability of diabetes, because it truly is a struggle. I work from home, and I found that in this past year, my diabetes has improved because I've had complete control over what I eat, when I eat, when I test my blood sugar. So I keep a close ear to the ground for the discussion that's happening on whether diabetes is a legitimate disability. I'm fully abled, and I want to be fully abled, but I do ask that my employer make some concessions to my schedule so that I can have better control. And I thank you so much for this conversation.
So could you tell me more about what kind of concessions would you like to have?
Well, I'm speaking about moments when I can test my sugar or take my insulin, when I can treat a low blood sugar, or I can feel in tune with my diabetes. In the past, I felt hesitant about telling my employer that I am a diabetic because I fear, repercussions and discrimination. It's not a source of shame for me. I listen very closely to conversations about diabetes, but I'm careful about what I say at work.
Right. I get that. And you have your privacy, and that needs to be totally respected. And so I appreciate your call. Thank you so much, Hildy. Roseanne Barajas, any ideas? What can employees ask of an employer? I mean, is there not a disability? What needs to happen here? What helps people? What helps people?
I think definitely having a conversation with your employer about your medical condition. Also, making them more aware of the ability to have these moments, as the caller pointed out, to assess where they are in the maintenance of their diabetes during the course of a work day. We know that stress in a work environment can raise blood sugars. So definitely having very honest conversations. There are other things that can happen. You can be an advocate for healthier options in the vending machine. You can opt for more selections of maybe water versus sodas in some of these other areas as well. We recognize that the burden of this disease is enormous on the patient themselves, on the person who has the disease, on their families, and on the community at large. You know, when we're talking about pediatric patients that are getting diagnosed at such a young age, and we think about the fact that these are youth that we want to see them go to their high school prom, that we look forward to them having their first job or joining the military, getting married. The burden of having type 2 diabetes in particular limits a lot of that. And for us who are reaching that age where retirement is in the horizon, you know, these are the individuals that we were hoping were going to be joining the workforce and healthy enough to take our place. And as my colleagues have shared, the tragedy of this disease is that they are sicker than what we'll be able to withstand in the workforce.
Let's go to another call, and we have Lou, but the number is 833-877-8255 if you want to call in. Hey, Lou, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I work in grocery stores. That's my business, and I'm always astounded at the amount of sugar that is taken up in displays. I think that parents should, if they could, look at how a grocery store is laid out, and all of that stuff that's at the front that's in displays invariably is processed food, high in sugar. We've got all the holidays coming with Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas, more sugar. And they've got to realize that sugar is so carefully crafted the mouthfeel, the salt, sugar, fat, taste and stuff, all that different, all those different varieties are, the deck is really stacked against parents. So it's education, and they've got to look at what they're putting in that cart. That's my comment.
Lou, thank you for that. Dr. Lynch, another curveball question about research. Do we know a lot about how different people perceive sweet and whether or not if that can be regulated?
Believe it or not, in utero, you develop your taste buds. So one of the reasons that we've had this explosion, I believe, in the last two generations is that the age of type 2 diabetes was already on the decreasing into from the 50s to 40s to 30s. And suddenly women were developing gestational and type 2 diabetes at pretty rapid rates that were either pre-existing to pregnancy or during pregnancy. And there are changes in the methylation of genes. If you're a fetus in utero with exposure to sugar, exposure to high insulin, and not only are you predisposed to obesity and earlier onset of type 2, by that change in your genes triggered by the exposure to diabetes in utero, you also have developed taste buds that are influenced by what your mother's eating during pregnancy. So we really do see some pretty dramatic changes in the last two generations. And Lou is absolutely right when he talked about the displays and the marketing to kids and what kids want to eat versus what we want to feed them, and how you do pretty quickly get somewhat addicted to that sugar, fat, salt content that is very carefully manipulated in a lot of foods targeted at kids.
Yeah, it's, you know, things that are sugar-coated, you know, frosted flakes, that it's great for getting diabetes should be the slogan for that product. Let's go to Suzette on the phones. Suzette, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, and I think the transition is perfect to my question. Is I just took up on a job with NEISD, and I know growing up and graduating from the same school district, the items that were offered in school, especially for breakfast, were caked on with syrup and other sugary items. And now being a mother of two, and I was diagnosed with gestational diabetes when pregnant with my second child, I worry about them and their choices when they go to school. Is even if we were to pack them breakfast or lunch, they see their peers beside them eating the sweet foods. My question is there any outlook of their potentially having better choices for them to choose from?
All right. I'm going to go back to Roseanne Barajas. This is your area, clinical research coordinator in pediatric type 2 diabetes at UT Health San Antonio.
So we definitely in San Antonio have worked diligently and have used this as a platform to go national, have worked diligently to work with the school systems and the nutritional programs within the school system to really educate them on the delivery of food items that are of healthier value for the child long term, taking into consideration the background of, is it a community that has a high rate of type 2 diabetes or heart disease or kidney disease. In conjunction with that, I will say that the UT Health Science Center in San Antonio, in partnership with the University Health System, the American Diabetes Association, and the YMCA, have launched a program five years ago to prevent diabetes in our youth. Camp Power Up, which has now taken on a national name through the American Diabetes Association called Project Power, is aimed at a week-long immersion in educating not only the child in the 8-to-5 setting during the summer, but also educating the parents on, as the previous caller and as this caller is sharing, on educating them on layouts of grocery stores, on making healthier food choices, on really being an advocate in the school system for your children with regards to healthier food options.
But also, Roseanne, but I have, you know, people are working, People are limited income. They're looking for cheap, quick calories in order to keep the family happy from one day to the next.
Absolutely. We recognize that. The Texas Diabetes Institute is in a community that is disenfranchised. Parents there, education level is less than desirable. And we recognize that these are true dilemmas that our youth and our parents in the community face. But the more we can educate them through the City of San Antonio's programs, the restaurants putting out their menus with calorie counts, grocery stores really advocating for changing the layouts of their merchandise, all play an intricate role in the success of these youth facing this disease.
All right, we're taking a break, and when we come back, we'll get more callers on the air. We're talking about Diabetes Week with youth and young adults and what happens when they get diagnosed with diabetes. What can be done to slow down this curve that we're seeing? This is really frightful. What are the risk factors, and what are some things that can be done for early prevention? The number is 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is Diabetes Week. We're talking about this issue the entire week because it is so important. Today, it is young adults, youth diabetes. We've got a question or a comment, call in 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. Dr. Fida Basha, Associate Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology and Diabetes at Baylor College of Medicine and the Texas Children's Hospital. What are the risk factors that we need to be paying attention to?
So the risk factors for type 2 diabetes in youth are first and foremost overweight and obesity, exposure to a maternal diabetes in utero, presence of other risk factors that suggest insulin resistance, such as high lipid levels, particularly triglycerides, and low good cholesterol, having higher blood pressure, having darkening of the skin, the neck, what we call acanthosis nigricans, family history of type 2 diabetes, and race, ethnic minorities, background that we know is associated with high risk for diabetes in childhood. So these are some of the risk factors that we need to keep in mind when we are assessing our patients. And if there is family history of diabetes and the child is overweight, the parent should try to start mitigating this risk early on, and they should be in conversation with their pediatrician to have the child monitored, hopefully for prevention of this disease.
So Dr. Jane Lynch, we have a child, they're overweight. You want to have that conversation, like you need to exercise, you need to get outside. It becomes, you're fat shaming me. It's not a good conversation.
No, it's not. And we want to meet the kids where they are at for what would motivate them. We actually have a social worker who works in our wellness clinic who does motivational interviewing. And you need to really connect with them at a time when they're willing to make some changes. So it might not be the first time you meet with them, or it might be when there's a red flag of some elevation of their average blood sugar. So we do talk about, with the high insulin and weight gain, the association with polycystic ovaries in some of our teenage girls. So really you have to find what resonates with each family to figure out what will motivate them for change. And often it's reflected with them making an appointment to see us as something where they've recognized it's a problem. But there's no silver magic bullet for this. And if there were, we'd be wealthy,
yeah,
rich.
But Roseanne Barajas, you can imagine the conversation. You sit down and you tell the child, you don't exercise, and you've got a lot of weight on you. And then the kid's going to say, what about you? You never exercise, and you're as big as a couch. Well, I mean, so the parents really need to be modeling good behavior, right?
So in our research studies with all of our patients, when we are doing diabetes education, we always make sure that the family understands that this is a family disease, that this child did not get to this point in their medical health condition without there being influencers on the outside. So we really do spend the time to educate the entire family. That's not to say that we haven't had families who only want the kid to be treated, and they'll hide the soda waters under their bed and drink them at night when the child is not around. But we really do try to stress that this is a family disease. And talking about weight gain, you know, I think all of us to a degree have put on what we call the COVID-19, those 19, 20 pounds over this last year and a half, similar to the freshman 15, where the routine has changed, the food choices have changed, and the weight has been put on. And the thing to understand is this data shows that the disruption of these routines are contributing to these alarming weight gains among our children. And when you talk about accelerated weight gain of 20 to 30 pounds in almost like a 6-month period, when you're usually seeing that over the course of a year or two as a child goes through puberty, those mitigating factors really do play into having pre-diabetes converted into diabetes, and then them being hospitalized because they have higher than normal blood sugars, even as a newly diagnosed, and higher A1Cs, going into diabetic ketoacidosis in the hospital that requires them to be in the ICU. So we really try to communicate that to our families, that this is a family disease, and to prevent some of these tragic situations occurring, there needs to be a real truthfulness in the conversation.
Let me go to the callers. We have Luvina Ludvina. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to know if local pediatricians are collaborating with schools to provide an in-school children health and diabetes education. And this is a preventive measure. Young children many times listen to their teachers messaging more willingly than they do their parents. And I know for myself, I have a grandchild that I raised, and he listened when he was very young to that messaging, and it kept up, you know, with that knowledge, and has acted on it. And I think for he himself, you know, motivates himself not to have sugary drinks and that type of thing.
Okay. Roseanne, but I have to be short on time. How much work are we doing with our school districts?
I think we're doing a good job. I think is there room for growth and improvement? Absolutely. But I think the yearly mandate of the Texas risk assessment for type 2 diabetes as it relates to acantosis, high blood pressure, BMIs, those are done in the first, third, fifth, and seventh grade. Those are the times that the nurses go in, they bring the kids out, they assess them, they send these precursor.
Yeah, but now here we are in COVID-19, and, you know, everything has been scrambled.
Exactly. And
right.
So the data for 2021 is missing, but, you know, we're hoping to get back into that program and assessing and addressing this at a much younger age with these patients.
Let's go to another caller. We have Robert. And Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. It's primarily about the lack of communication between the primary care and the endocrinologist, unless I provide them with the lab, one or the other, because they order separately, and it's usually at different times, so more sticks. And then when we ask the endocrinologist to have a consult with a dietitian to help with meal planning, nothing happens. I asked that question on the last visit like 3 weeks ago, and no one's called yet.
All right, Robert, thank you for that. Dr. Jane Lynch, all of these handoffs with one patient with this big problem, things get messed up.
Yeah, we have a pretty fractured medical system, especially here in San Antonio. We, at least for kids, we have a team and we send our note to the pediatrician after the visit. We have a nutritionist in our clinic who meets with the families either at that time or by phone to follow, but it's not reimbursed. A lot of our education is not reimbursed in the current Medicaid and insurance rules, and our wait list is large and our volume is high. So we all feel like we could do a better job with this. And we have a lot of room for improvement with a lot of silos of records and charts. I agree.
So Dr. Lynch, I see commercials on TV for some sort of gizmos that you now like attach to yourself that will monitor your blood sugar constantly with your smartphone. Do these things work? Isn't it a good advance?
We love them. Yes. And we had to fight very hard to get Medicaid approval for those for children, which came through in the past 6 months. We really upticked our use of the technology during COVID. However, many people have very high durable medical equipment copays, and it's still not always affordable. So they do work. I think they're the vision for how we will monitor blood sugars in the future, and they're very helpful.
And it worth the investment? I mean, how much are we talking about here?
Thousands of dollars. And it's variable. The same way our medical system is variable for your copay and your insurance coverage. So we go in and try and get it authorized and approved. It's probably, it's easier for type 1 than type 2 as well.
But it can save lives?
It can give you insight to what your blood sugar patterns are.
Help you manage
it. You still need to do the work. And this is not a very forgiving disease, especially in kids, especially during puberty.
Dr. Fida Basha, what do you want to see happening right now?
This is a problem that is, a societal issue, a public health issue. So we should continue working all together as a society to improve the health conditions of our children. For young people, and particularly for families who struggle with diabetes and they have children at risk, please think about prevention. Think about how to do lifestyle changes to prevent diabetes from happening. If you suspect your child has diabetes, please don't delay seeking medical care so that treatment can be initiated early. We have shown that this can slow the progression of the disease. And let's keep this conversation going with the healthcare professionals. We're here to help.
All right, Dr. Fida Basha, Associate Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology and Diabetes at Baylor College of Medicine and the Texas Children's Hospital. We also spoke with Rose Ann Barajas at the UT Health San Antonio and Dr. Jane Lynch, Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Jackie Velez and Xiaowen Chen. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.